Six listeners can't be wrong.
Yeah, six listeners cannot be wrong. Rob Wolf.
Andy Dees. The Paleo Solution.
Holy cow. Gads.
Rob Wolf, Andy Dees back with episode 59, The Paleo Solution. It is not raining in Chico today. How are you?
It's not raining, but it's overcast.
Well, it's that time of year, man. As I told your wife when you guys got back from Hawaii, you know, it's stunning that it's actually even sunny here this time of year. So, you know, you got to take what you can get.
It's true, but like I also like to point out, it is winter here, and I guess maybe that's typical. But I think I'm preferring winter almost any place else, just as long as there's some sun. It could be minus 50 degrees, but if the sun is out, then I'm not scratching at the windows, like, contemplating my own doom, so.
Well, I have my one client that, you know, lives here and works in Winnipeg every week, and I get these texts. It is minus 35, you know, Celsius, Andy, Celsius or something, and I'm like, oh, it's so much worse than how I have it.
Yes.
So I think we got a bunch of stuff to cover real quick, Rob. What do you want to start with here? What kind of shenanigans do you want to talk about?
Let's see here. We've got Sarah Fragoso of Everyday Paleo rolling on the show here pretty soon. The infamous Matt Lalonde, who will answer all of your questions and offer a scientific beatdown while he does it, will be on here pretty quickly. Art Devaney, we did a tweet chat with Art, and Art wants to come on the show, so we'll have him on. We'll get Lauren Cordain on here pretty soon. Lauren's actually in the process of writing another book, so he's kind of gone to ground for a while, but we'll get him on here. Paleo Physicians Network, sites being built, more details to follow, but hopefully early January, sometime in January, we should have that thing up and running. Like that's the theory. We'll see how that rolls out, but super excited about that. We wrapped up the last two Paleo Solution seminars for 2010, one in Hawaii, one in Woodinville, and then the format is changing and the content is changing and expanding, and I'll get some details on that and the schedule for 2011 up real soon, but folks should be pretty stoked with that. And then I don't know if folks know, but Andy Dees and his beard have a blog. Do you want to tell folks about it?
I get these funny questions. So, my blog is at chasingcapacity.com. This is basically an outgrowth of annoying Rob when I see him at the gym, and I figured I'm just going to write all this stuff down rather than annoy him while he's training, and then he can read it if he wants, and other people can read it if they want. And so... currently finishing my never-ending 14-part series of my love-hate relationship with CrossFit.
Yeah, and Andy is very, very popular. He scores a visit from CrossFit Legal occasionally when he posts these things. So we're making friends, influencing people and making friends.
That's
like
right.
Always.
Yeah. That's right.
Dale Carnegie style.
But you know what's funny, Ron? This is what's actually funny, is that I don't really think I hate CrossFit, but I get this funny email from someone the other day on Facebook, like, hey, I'm choosing between going to my level one and this Charles Staley seminar. I think I know the answer, but what do you think? And I was like, dude, just because it's CrossFit doesn't mean I hate it. You know, like, I think there are some valid principles to be gleaned from it. Do I think it's everything? No, but nothing is everything, right? Nothing is magic.
Yeah. And that's kind of some of the funny stuff that I know for just my own situation, kind of the HQ hyperbole is that I hate CrossFit and everything, which is kind of funny considering how much support we provide on like business systems, teaching people how to more effectively coach people, more effectively handle nutrition and whatnot. And so it's more, I just kind of think the great wall of CrossFit that I think that we have an issue with, where when you wall yourselves off and you make your methodology unassailable and define your own terms and then allow nobody in to input on them, then you've got problems. And the problems are more internal and systemic than they are dealing with the outside world. Like, everybody else is going to tinker and expand, and either they evolve and develop, or everybody else does. So,
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how all that goes. And I'm sure this will score us another nasty gram. So
sweet.
Merry Christmas, folks.
Yeah, someone sent me a nice post this week, a really nice woman that owns an affiliate, I guess. And she basically, you know, was saying, like, everything that I said I hated about CrossFit, that they didn't do at her box. And so I was like, dude, awesome. Like, if you don't do that stuff, cool, right on to you. But it's like, I just feel like we'd run into a lot of people that I think still do stuff wrong in the way we see the world. So, you know, I feel like just like this podcast is trying to share our opinion about different things, like that's the same thing we're trying to accomplish with all that other stuff.
Totally. So yeah, so folks can check that out at chasingcapacity.com and get more of Andy and his shenanigans. And instead of him just assailing me as I walk out of the bathroom at NorCal Strength and Conditioning, then it is on the internet forever. So.
That's right. And now you can read it or leave it, Rob. It's amazing how that works. I will no longer ask you if that's a universal movement pattern while we're hollow rocking.
Perfect. Hollow rocking is a gymnastics term, by the way. I just want to clarify that.
Are you ready for questions? We've had 5 minutes.
Andy has picked some spicy ones this week, trying to provoke me like usual. So,
dude, it's almost the holidays, Rob. We got to get some spicy ones in before you go to ground for a few weeks and recover for 2011.
Okay.
All right. Number one question from Tom. Hey, Rob and Andy. First off, epic intro in the podcast.
Indeed.
Well, thank you. We had nothing to do with it, but we appreciate it. Question, pronounce this as Dwight does in the Office US version. I don't even remember how Dwight does that, Rob.
Question.
That's right. Been paleo for close to a year, was lonely at first here in Amsterdam, but there seems to be a surge in intelligent, young, healthy cavemen here, so the work I'm putting in to build a community here starts to pay off. I'm 6'3", 175, which is kind of pathetic, and about 6% body fat. I work out 2 times a week, lifting heavy weights, doing compound exercises. I've tried to build mass several times. I'd like to get to around 190, but I've been unsuccessful. What I think is the problem is this. I used to IF before working out, and I used to not take any starch carbs post-workout. If I'm right, when glycogen levels in the body are depleted after workout, especially after an IF, and not replenished quickly, the body starts to cannibalize muscle mass, especially if you have a high metabolism like me. So all the muscle I could be gaining is leveled by the muscle I'm losing due to insufficient post-carb intake. My gym is pretty far from home, 30 minutes travel, so I was wondering if a post-workout shake with honey for the carb intake would do the trick, and if not, what does? Hope this gets answered. You guys are my favorite source of hour-long humor-induced ramblings about evolutionary biology. Take care.
It's nice that we're the favorite one, but I think that's a really rarefied pool of talent. So.
It's like our Good Will Hunting moment again. There's only like 3 people that you could pick, and we won.
Yeah. We happen to have a pulse. Everybody else, their head is frozen in like suspended animation, waiting to be defrosted like Walt Disney at some point. So, yeah, you know, this is kind of a classic deal of, you know, always framing the question, who are you? What are your needs? And if you're 6'3", 175 pounds, intermittent fasting may be absolutely antagonistic to your goals. Maybe not, but, you know, definitely the primary focus is like you need to feed yourself adequately. Like that is just kind of first and foremost deal with all that. And then from there, like, would a post-workout shake be appropriate? Yeah, it totally could be appropriate, especially in this situation. Looking at some sort of a whey protein isolate, maybe some coconut water plus like maltodextrin and stuff like that. Waxy maize starch could be some of the options that you go with that. I was having a good conversation with Ido Portal about this, and you know, he acknowledges some of the effects of like the gallon of milk a day kind of gig, but the analogy he made was that the GOMAD, you know, a Big Eat plus GOMAD was kind of like using a screw and hammering it into a spot that you would normally use a nail. Or, you know, basically it's like a blunt force tool instead of a precision tool. And Ido is another person that will get on the show here at some point. But, like, I've done a bunch of tinkering of late of, you know, decreasing my caffeine intake, getting some acupuncture, taking some herbs, which we have a question later that asked me about some supplements and stuff like that. But basically just looking at the results of an ASI test, looking at the results of some biosignature stuff, and seeing really wickedly high cortisol levels, probably because of owning a gym and traveling and doing all the rest of this stuff. But I took some time to just get my hormonal ducks in a row. And lo and behold, like, I'm putting on muscle mass. I'm feeling way better. I've been tinkering with a whey protein coconut water shake post-workout and feeling really good with that and getting leaner. And but, you know, the interesting thing is kind of focusing on the hormonal environment first. And if you tend to be that really super skinny, hard gainer type, I think putting a little focus on the nutrition, but particularly putting a focus on anything that can mitigate cortisol release, lack of sleep, stress, too much caffeine, certainly metabolic conditioning. Like, you really want to keep an eye on all that stuff and put all your ducks in a row focused on muscle mass gain and just kind of low cortisol levels. So I would consider ditching the intermittent fasting altogether in this situation. Definitely consider a post-workout shake scenario, and then look at like a solid food meal that would be like some protein and maybe like yam or sweet potato, maybe 45 minutes after the shake.
Also, I'm just going to throw this out. Is it possible that our friend Tom is, it is unlikely in my opinion, that the only and primary reason that we're not gaining mass is that he doesn't have a post-workout shake.
No, he's probably under-eating all the way around. Yeah, which Andy has been on a tear around the gym trying to get everybody to eat more, which I think is super important to point out with this. I mean, there's a lack of calories overall, for sure.
And potentially, depending on what you got going on, we don't know, Tom, never met Tom, that, you know, maybe two times a week isn't enough, who knows. But I agree, cortisol and all that stuff, but I feel like we have this, you know, all these things I think are pretty multifactorial, and so it becomes super easy to come up with like, hey, man, I know that if you just have a post-workout shake, you're going to gain 15 pounds, and I feel like there's probably a lot of other stuff going on.
Yeah.
Even though it'd be cool if all you needed was a post-workout shake, because then,
right.
then we could get you some Progenics, and you would be ripped.
Jacked. So like a day's plan here would be like roll out of bed, the classic Polican meat and nuts breakfast, you know, some protein, some fat, get your workout on, maybe a post-workout shake, a solid food meal, maybe about 45 minutes later with a pretty good whack of protein, but a even larger whack of carbs, and then going more into the protein and fat meals, shooting for 5,000 calories a day, I would say would be a good spot to be with all this. Keeping an eye on the amount of body fat you gain and all that, and whatever body fat you gain should be ideally be evenly distributed. If it all just starts log jamming in the midsection, then we've got some sort of hormonal problem. We've got some sort of like a liver, you know, problem going on, such that we're not getting estrogen clearance, we're not getting testosterone production or something like that. So this is where like having somebody, a good naturopath or somebody who knows some biosignature, somebody who can look under the hood and see what your hormone status is going to help a ton, and you're going to get a lot more benefit out of your efforts.
Yes, and realize gaining 15 pounds of mass is going to take much longer than losing 15 pounds of fat.
Yeah.
Infinitely on. Cool. Good question. Thanks, Tom. It's been about 6 months living in the Netherlands when I was a traveling man. Cool part of the world. Although red light district is a little much for me. That's all I'm going to say.
One can burn through a week's paycheck pretty quickly.
So. Yes, no matter how high it is.
Or so I've heard.
Cool. Now we got a question from Dan. A few quick questions. Sorry if they've been addressed in here already and I couldn't find them. So, Rob, we'll just answer them one by one. We'll ask one and then answer. So, number one, you mentioned artificial sweeteners briefly and said you'd get back to that subject, but if you've addressed them, again, I missed it. Is it in the book somewhere or on here somewhere that I could read more about it?
Yeah, it's covered extensively in the book, and I mean, the short answer on that is that the artificial sweeteners can and do chuck and jive the body into releasing insulin, despite the fact that it's a non-nutritive sweetener. It also has some effects on the hypothalamus. that can be really nasty for our energy regulation, metabolic regulation of energy output. Taking in the non-nutritive sweeteners can kind of trick the brain into thinking that we have calories coming in, and then when we don't have those calories coming in, then we can get some problems down the road. I just don't see people lean out to the degree that they want using artificial sweeteners. That said, if you're going to go out and have a couple of drinks, is doing like some vodka and diet Sem-It-Up the worst thing in the world? No, that's probably what I would opt for. But I don't have metabolic problems and don't have leanness problems currently. So that's, you know, again, who are you? What are the situations? If somebody's trying to lose body fat or they've got any type of metabolic problems, I would not use artificial sweeteners at all.
Yeah, Rob, now that you're leaning out, I'm thinking we could do a spoof of the Sean Phillips Ab Diet book now.
Let's do it. I'm in.
We will have really jumped the shark then, for sure.
We just need to keep jumping back and forth over the shark and just provoke the shark. So
poke the bear. I like it.
Yeah.
Number two, I live in Colorado, so really nothing but evergreens are in season here. Are most fruits and veggies, berries, apples, broccoli, spinach, etc., still okay, even though they obviously don't come from anywhere around here?
You know, again, kind of who are you and what do you have going on? If you know, the whole lights out refrain of going real low carb during the winter, I think is appropriate for most of the people that we encounter. But I think we're also getting a little bit of a sense that if you're already quite lean, that maybe sneaking in a little bit of carbs, particularly post-workout carbs, would probably be of benefit to you potentially. And but then in that case, personally, I would just opt more for like the yam sweet potato kind of gig, even though Art Devaney calls that stuff hunter-gatherer starvation food. I personally do a lot. He's so awesome. But I personally just feel a lot better when I'm doing like a yam or sweet potato kind of gig versus really doing fruit at all. And when you look at the fructose metabolism and all that, like, you know, it's not the best stuff in the world to be throwing down the pie hole. So that's just kind of a personal preference for myself. So I would stick with like a lot of broccoli, spinach, etc. And then if you're pretty lean, then I would go with like a yam or sweet potato post-workout to get a little more carbs. And I would just kind of chill it on the fruit for a while, personally.
Yeah, I think we'll have Mr. Lalonde talk about that at length, probably.
Yeah. And he will probably like break a baby harp seal's neck while he's talking about it. Just, ah! So, yeah.
Poor Matt, we're going to get messages after this episode for sure.
Painting him like a monster. He's like, F you guys, I'm not coming on there, man.
We'll blame Wellborn, it's his fault.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, cool. And third question from Dan. I think you talked about it a little bit, but what are your thoughts on ketosis, ketogenic diets? I was thinking about doing keto before a friend recommended your book.
I think they're awesome for the appropriate people. Folks who are super, super lean, I just think they would benefit from probably a little bit of carb refeeding post-workout. And this is something that Matt and I have talked about of length more and more, just like once you hit that level of pretty significant leanness, maybe even starting off the day with a little bit more carbs. Like my orientation is shifting for leaner people towards a little more carb lenient, maybe even carb promoting stance. You know, again, kind of paleo varieties, more yam and sweet potato, more starch oriented than fruit oriented, tons of veggies. But for the right people, I think that ketogenic intervention is just magic, like absolutely magic for reversing metabolic problems, for reducing inflammation. But then there's that U-shaped graph that I think we talked about the not last week because that was Tim Ferriss, but the week before that, that there are kind of therapeutic dose windows on all this stuff. And by tinkering with intermittent fasting and different things, I think you can dip in and out of a ketogenic state, and there's a lot of benefit to that on the hormesis and anti-aging side of things. But it doesn't have to be an all-or-nothing event. And like what I think Matt's going to talk about when we get him on here is that when we induce that transient insulin resistance that is characteristic of a low-carb diet, it may not be the best thing in the world to then hammer a large carbohydrate meal just out of nowhere into an individual that's in that state. And so then we need to really be a little bit more savvy about how we're recommending this stuff. But I think, again, like that, taking advantage of the post-workout window for some carbs is a really good place. It's kind of a best of all worlds kind of scenario.
Yeah, I think that's just like you mentioning that I've been hammering certain people to eat more. I don't think that's an all-inclusive recommendation, but we're seeing, you know, hard-training athletes that maybe need more carbohydrates and very big, lean men that eat like little girls and probably shouldn't.
Right. Yeah, when Katie DeLuca ends up eating far more calorie content, and she's like 5'2" and like 113 pounds, then, yeah, she's eating more food than some of our 200-pound males. So. But oddly enough, still looks better. So,
yeah. Shocker. Yes. Cool. Now we got a question from Phil. Dear Andy, quotation, president of the Beard Club for Mendees, I'm addressing this message to you since we all know you're the puppet master in this operation.
Indeed.
Okay. First, the usual, love the podcast, been listening since there are only 5 listeners. Great stuff, week in and week out. I particularly like the training-related info. Editor's note, so do I.
What, you don't want to talk food more?
Well, it's not that I don't want to talk. It's just less interesting for me as opposed to you, you know. We have our own little niches.
Luckily, yes.
Thank goodness. 2 questions for you. How much time will my body need to transition to paleo and be able to perform at a reasonable high level? For example, I've got my first half marathon coming up. From listening to the podcast, I know that switching to paleo 2 weeks before the event would probably be a bad idea.
Yeah. Oh, wait, I thought this was addressed to you.
Well, I'll answer, too. Yes, or check, as we say in our gym. I don't want to comment on running a half marathon. Right on, dude. Do it once. Never again. I'm just in an anti-running phase this week.
Right.
I would give, you know, 6 to 8 weeks at least before an event, before I'd at least to adjust that, Rob. You buy that?
Yeah, totally. And I think if you check out like Paleo Diet for Athletes, where Joe Friel is talking about this, if you pick up any of the training Bible books, I did a couple of posts like The Zone and Athletic Performance and a couple other ones where I look at the transition time to like a ketogenic diet and all that. You it's too much of a demanding event to really shift the fueling right before that. You're going to be right in the window of like kind of maximum suck potentially. So I would just wait until that's done, and then you can do some significant tinkering then.
I think it's great you brought up the Paleo Diet for Athletes thing. I've had a couple interactions over the past 3 weeks with some of our clients and people on the internet that were eating what I would call low-carb paleo, but then were training like they were endurance athletes for marathons, and there was a bit of incongruence, I think, their work output compared to what they were putting in their body, perhaps. And so I feel like it's a good reminder that stuff is out there. Like, hey, if you're an endurance athlete but you are eating paleo, there may be some modifications that you would make to your food as compared to, hey, I'm an endurance athlete, or I'm eating paleo and I lift weights heavy 3 days a week for an hour.
Right, right. And, we're working on a part of the site update is going to be a series of kind of flow charts, like are you overweight, yes or no? Do you have metabolic derangement, yes or no? And kind of like going through this stuff. And another one of the things is, are you an athlete, yes or no? What flavor? Power athlete, endurance athlete? And so we'll try to block some flow charts out. And there's some things to consider, which actually kind of leads us into the question that's coming up next. But, your fueling should kind of reflect to some degree what block of training you're in. And if you're in kind of a base building aerobic capacity, like an aerobic enzyme training phase, then a low-carb paleo and trained in a fasted state could be super beneficial, like really, really beneficial. Apparently, USA Triathlon is pushing a very low-carbohydrate, intermittent fasted part of their training phase when you're doing that like 60-70% heart rate training for like 2 or 3 hours a day type stuff, building that big aerobic base and trying to train the fat mobilizing enzymes to be really efficient. But then when you start getting into competitive phase, when you're going to be going in and out of aerobic and glycolytic efforts with sprint training and stuff like that, then you need more carbohydrate. Like there's just absolutely no doubt about that. I think some people in kind of CrossFit land can get away on very low carbohydrate dietarily because they get very fat efficient, but then also because of the relatively high protein intake that they have, they're actually repleting glycogen by some gluconeogenesis, and it's just kind of different ways to slice and dice it. But there's some really good resources. Joe Friel's books, the whole Training Bible series, Triathletes Training Bible, Runners Training Bible, Swimmers Training Bible, all of those recommend the paleo diet. And it's kind of funny. Most endurance athletes have one, if not all of those books, and none of them have read the nutrition section in there. So I think they look at it and they're like, wait, caveman, I don't get it. You know, it's not goo and Cytomax and stuff. And it's not to say that goo and Cytomax don't have their place, but there's just smarter ways that you can tackle this. And hopefully our flowchart deal will help people kind of dial in where they are and what they need to do.
Once we transcribe the flowchart, Rob, then we're done.
Yes. Yes.
Good. And then number two, any thoughts on CrossFit endurance training, particularly wondering if all the two-a-day workouts fall into the beating the tar out of yourself category?
You know, I really like BMAC. I like what they do in general, but this is one spot where I just diverge from CrossFit in general and then the CrossFit endurance scene also, in that I really think you need some sort of a block periodization approach to this stuff. In a block method for like a microcycle or mesocycle, I think doing a lot of what the randomized training, the huge spread of intervals, the smart use of strength work is totally appropriate for different people. And here again, like depending on what your event is, like if you run 5 and 10 Ks and your time indexing is generally in that like, you know, 10 to 30 minute realm or something like that, CrossFit endurance may be just about all that you need. I would still argue that if you're a 5 or a 10K runner, you should probably get out and do some 5 and 10K runs more frequently than not to kind of like get used to and the pacing and the demands of that stuff, just a little bit of sport specificity. But as you step this stuff out further and further, you need to do some volume work. And part of this stuff, volume and duration work, and part of this just relates into like the central governor theory of our metabolism while we're training. Like our brain knows how much protein, carbohydrate, and fat we have stored in our system. And when we do deep inroads into those stores through training, if the body isn't used to going in and out of that nutrient flux, then you can freak the system out and you'll bonk. And this is a lot of the problem that people have who do too much interval work and not enough just long work. And particularly when we start talking about like these 50 to 100 mile foot races and 3 day long like Xterra type events and stuff like that, you've just got to start going out long, both psychologically and physiologically to get ready for it. So again, this thing goes back to who are you and what do you need to do? So CrossFit endurance, good or bad? Well, it could be really good for some people. It could be not so great for other people. I think in general, it would still benefit people to put a little bit of block periodization into that whole format. And there's an interesting thing with this stuff. Say like we take a 100-meter sprinter, 200-meter sprinter. If we bathe their muscles in a bunch of lactate, we convert them from a very, very fast person to a less fast person. A really long endurance athletes, if we bathe their muscle fibers at the wrong time in their training cycle in a bunch of lactate, we actually decrease their ability to mobilize fat as an energy source over the long haul. And it impacts negatively their ability to produce force in that aerobic pathway. And this is one of the things that beat people up at, say, like Tour de France kind of gig, is that the demands of the race actually go in and out of the glycolytic pathway sufficiently frequently that you start getting like some fiber type changes and some metabolic changes that are damaging to long-term output. And so this is the some of the struggle, and I am not an endurance coach. Like I just dabble in this stuff, but there's some pretty well understood things here that I think if folks were to bring to bear on this type of training, they could get more juice out of the whole thing.
Yes. And I don't have any comment against CrossFit endurance or pros or con, but I think your comment about what kind of athlete are you trying to be is an important question. And the other thing, I posted something on Facebook from Hank K, who I'll never remember how to pronounce his last name, but Olympic coach in the Netherlands, and he basically made some statement about that at all levels we should be seeking to do as little as we need to be successful, as opposed to not as much as possible.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I keep coming back to the theme for some of the people you run into that are kind of the opposite. Let's do as much. Like, if we can do CrossFit 6 days a week, rock on. And I'm like, well, do you really need that based on what your goals are trying to be? You know, what are you trying to turn into? So, anyway, that's my own little soapbox for today. Cool. Good question. And now we have a question from Handle This. I understand that carbs are most appropriate post-workout. That's the win, but how do we gauge the as appropriate in terms of amount? Also, for very extended events, low-level hiking, maybe several days in a row with a pack, what is the peri and post-effort quantity calculation? Also, for how long does win last? Is it the hours post, or could it be for a day or more if effort was significant? Just looking for some rules of thumb, a la the 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, i.e. grams of a carbohydrate per hour. Thanks, as always.
You know, this kind of gets into the sniffing more of an endurance orientation on this stuff. And, you know, honestly, it's just to some degree outside my wheelhouse. Like, it's just not in my area of interest. And so I don't tackle it with much vigor because I just don't care. Endurance athletics, I just flat don't fucking care. That said, sorry, Handle This. But, you know, James Fitzgerald does some really good kind of repletion schedules on this. Poliquin has done some stuff on this. I tried tinkering with this, with the performance menu, writing some templates. There was recently a piece, I need to dig up the link on it, where a guy put together a massively complex paper describing what your carb repletion schedule should be. And it's like how many kilograms you weigh and what your, understood VO2 maxes in a particular endeavor, and then what percentage of that VO2 max you were at for a given period of time, and then you could precisely re-carb load. And I'll try to track that down, and we can put it in the show notes. And it's like 45 pages long, and it's a like American Journal of Physiology paper, and so you can geek out on that. But what I find that works really well for the majority of people, you know, is just simply like, did you eat enough carbs to recover for the thing that you need to do next? And you get some sort of a gut-level sense of what you're up to. Okay, I packed this long and this hard today. And then, and you know, generally for backpacking, you may not need much carbs at all because it's generally very, very fat-fueled. So this, again, starts going into that thing of, like, do you even need any, or how much of it do you actually need? Do you want to be carbohydrate-fueled while you're on a long backpacking trip because the carbs are relatively expensive relative to the fat with regards to weight and the caloric density and all that sort of jive. So there's a bunch of different moving parts here, but I mean, my whole thing on the carbohydrate refeeding is basically this. Use enough to be ready to do what you need to do. And you just need to play with that a little bit. That's my approach on it. I don't have anything really much beyond that. And again, it's probably because I just don't have much interest in it. I don't really care all that much. beyond there is you can get in. We'll try to track down that thing on the marathoning and all that sort of jive. But I mean, it's this gargantuan paper, 45 pages long, and a bunch of calculus in it, and all this sort of stuff, and it just leaves me drooling on myself. I read the whole thing on a flight, really trying to get excited about the whole topic, and I just don't care. So I know that's kind of a cop-out answer, but that's where I'm at. I mean, the fundamental thing is replete enough to be ready to do what you're going to do next. And if you're trying to prepare for the unknown and the unknowable, then I guess you're just screwed. Because you don't know what it is, so there's no way to prepare. So there you go.
Rob, I'm going to counter your anti-endurance athlete comments there. Just say, for me, low-level hiking is different than doing 12 Ironmans in a year. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the thing, again, you know, like, who are you? What are your needs? Do you even really need carbohydrate repletion? So, I mean, this question just becomes really specious all the way around, and I think for most people, then, it just kind of boils down to have enough to do what you need to do. And then some people may not even really need all that much, so...
Yeah, and as you said, especially if you're relatively well fat adapted, and it's actually low level hiking, you know, as opposed to a 100-mile bicycle race.
Yeah, and like you've there's some you know, time criticality to it. You're really pushing hard, so yeah.
Yep. Cool. Next, got a question from Jennifer Robb. Is this one of your spicy questions right here? Is this one?
Yes. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. And it's yeah. Yeah. I apologize, folks, up front. I'm gonna get a little spun up about this one. So if you have kids listening, I'm just telling you right now, I'm gonna get spun up about this one.
So please, Rob, I want you to take a deep breath and take a step back.
You picked this question and you didn't provoke me. So don't look like you're the arbiter of reason here. You're the provocateur.
Well, people enjoy when you're spun out, and this is actually some of the spiciest questions are actually some of the ones that I feel like need to be answered or interesting. Honestly, with over like well over 1,000 questions sitting in the queue, in the email queue alone, you know, I try to avoid the "I am 6 foot tall, 180 pounds, I eat 13 blocks of the zone, you know, I want to lose 4 pounds, please help me" questions, because those just aren't that interesting, I feel like, and they make me want to kill myself.
I'm just warning people up front that this one's going to get me going.
Fair enough, and I think it's fair. So here we go. Question from Jennifer. Has a properly executed paleo solution ever failed, i.e. no improvement in blood readings of cholesterol, triglycerides, no increase in energy, or no change in the insulin response? Do you want to start there, Rob? Or do you want me to read through a bunch of this?
Let's read the whole thing.
Because she
actually wraps up with that same exact statement, because she's very, very concerned about this, and this is a key thing of why I'm mad. So,
secondly, what is the lesser of two evils according to the paleo solution? White bread pasta or whole grain bread pasta? I'm 48-year-old mom of two boys, 5'9", weigh 125. I am fit, toned, and trimmed, and keep myself that way by my lifestyle of activity. I play golf and or tennis up to 4 to 5 times a week, walk frequently, do yoga, and generally use life as my exercise, i.e. carry my groceries, take stairs, elevator, etc., but I do no workout. I watch little TV and prefer books and puzzles instead. You could say it's in my genes, but perhaps it's because I grew up always with a garden and eating plenty of fresh vegetables, but few potatoes, fruit, little soda, sweets, except dark chocolate. I quit eating dairy about 10 years ago and never have liked the effect of corn or beans on my digestive system, so I generally avoid them. My blood work is excellent according to my doctors, and I have no known health-related issues. I have read Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price, Protein Power, Milk the Deadly Poison, Lights Out, and the Paleo Solution. I have a son who has been on a ketogenic diet for 8 years for GLUT1DS, which is... GLUT1 transporter deficiency syndrome. Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
We had a question about that many podcasts ago. Yeah.
Yep. And she has a link for those who want to find out more what that is. And I feel I'm very knowledgeable about the makeup of food. I have gone paleo for about 2 weeks and generally feel awful and am continually hungry or dissatisfied. I'll stick it out a few more weeks to make my assessment. My objective is not for myself, but my husband. He has all the biomarkers for overall information. His age is 46, 5'9", constantly battles with his weight. Though with working out, he's able to stay around 200 pounds. Cholesterol without medication is about 240. Triglycerides are about 220. LDL is below 35, or HDL is below 35. LDL around 170. He has bouts with heartburn and has had at least one large gallstone. 9 months ago, he had an angiogram that resulted in a stent to a 90% blocked artery. The other arteries were said to have been approximately 20% blocked. Since then, he's been on... Plavix, aspirin, statins, and I make him take omega-3 and vitamin D. He comes from an Italian background, lots of pasta, bread, pizza, cakes, and cookies. Won't eat nuts or seeds, few vegetables, and no fruit. He prefers high-carb, sugary snacks, candy, and soda, and though he doesn't indulge as often as he would like. He watches TV most evening for several hours. He won't read Lights Out or Paleo Solution, and though I've tried to share the information with him, keeping my marriage together always stops the conversation. Therefore, has the Paleo Solution ever failed, and which is worse, white or whole grains?
Okay, so in scientific truthfulness, like there's a huge selection bias here. Like there could be theoretically there could be tons and tons and tons of people that have tried the paleo solution and it failed, and they're just kind of like, well, I like Rob and Andy, they're nice guys. I'm not going to mention that the thing failed and bum them out and all the rest of that stuff. So I mean, in all honesty, you know, asking has it failed? I can't answer that with 100%, confidence that it's never failed. But what Jennifer is fishing for here, what's the unwritten question here is it worthwhile to give it a shot, and how often does it work? And what the reality is that this works every fucking time that somebody will actually do it. And I get that what you're doing is you're kind of fishing around this for your husband, but this dude literally is Donatello from the book. Like, this is him, the Italian dude who works and is overweight and has a stent and the whole rest of it. And if the dude is unwilling to change his life to save his life, what I recommend to Jennifer is take him down to the insurance shop, stock him up on life insurance, and let him eat whatever the hell he wants, and then wait for him to kick off, and then there's Raul the pool boy. And let the dude listen to this and let it percolate into his brain that his lifestyle and eating choices are going to leave him with a widow and kids that have no father. And if that doesn't light some sort of a fire under his ass, then that's just too goddamn bad. Because this is where it's at. Like, this is a no-joke situation. The dude is going to die. He's in the process of dying. He's got probably a window of opportunity where he can pull it back from the abyss, but that's if he can man up and get his balls in line and do what he needs to do. And it's enraging to me because we deal with people, we get questions from people who are dying from cancer, have all kinds of problems going on. Do every damn thing that you can to help these people who have no other solution, no other option, and they're grasping at straws. And then you have a guy like this who can do it if he chose to and is choosing not to. So it just absolutely enrages me, and I have no sympathy, I don't care. It's just bullshit and it's excuses. And you need to man up and do something different. And the whole question of, like, white bread or whole grain doesn't fucking matter. They're both bad.
Gluten is death.
So, sorry, folks, but, you know, doing some consulting with another girl with a melanoma and, like, trying to figure out how to help these people, and she's actually doing really, really well. They caught it early, and it looks like she's doing great. She's been working with a naturopath. I've been helping where I can, too, but this stuff just gets me so spun up when you have people who could choose to do something. And your life is so damn precious, and these changes are not that big a deal. They're really not. But for some people, I guess life just isn't that important to them. Like, I was so sick, and I really thought I was going to die at one time, that, like, every day I have feels like a blessing for me. And I'm just hugely grateful for it. And so when stuff like this comes in, like, I get that people are resistant. But, you know, the whole reason why Paleo Brands happened, the food company Paleo Brands, Joe Capuccio, which he's Italian, he started doing paleo and felt way better. And then he told his Italian wife, or not wife, but mother, who's in her late 60s, who's from Italy, you know, told her about paleo, and she did it. He just said, "Mom, don't eat this, this, and this. Eat these things." And she was like, "Okay." And, like, her hair that had fallen out grew back in. Her rheumatoid arthritis went into remission, and she put on muscle mass and felt better. And, like, that's the way they eat now. Like, that's just it. So the whole, like, Italian thing, like, everybody wants to pull the Italian card or the Asian card or whatever. Guess what? My family is from Arkansas, and we, like, grits and a bunch of other crappy food. Nobody gets a genetic buy on, like, oh, it's just woven in my genetics or my culture or whatever. It's crap. You either make a decision to change for a better life or you don't. And I don't really care one way or the other, but for Jennifer, I would sit down and really analyze what the heck's going on with this, and if you're not going to make forward progress with them, then that's kind of that.
Yes, and back to the question about, I've gone paleo for about 2 weeks, generally feel awful and continually hungry or dissatisfied. I'll stick it out for a few more weeks to make my assessment. I think anytime we see a change or a shift in food intake, we often see periods where folks, obviously your body has to adjust, so I think you got to give it the full 30 to 45 days and see what happens.
Yeah, and I'm kind of guessing that probably her food isn't quite as good as I would guess. Like, if she wants to throw in what her meal plan was before and what it is now, I would guess that there were probably more carbs and more refined foods in there than what she's kind of leading us to believe.
Yeah, and that actually brings up a great question, a great point. If we talk about someone's question on the air and they want to respond, it is probably faster if they respond to the comments of that individual episode, because the general rate of questions that we get in comes so fast, it is hard to then dig one up. So, like, Jennifer, if you want to throw something into the comments for this episode, that would be awesome.
Cool.
Cool.
Now her husband is probably going to track me down and kill me for being a dick, but oh well.
It's all right. My favorite question is not till the end, Rob. So.
Great. Those were holdovers from the last one when we ran out of time. So.
Yes. It's like this never-ending it's a never-ending story, Rob.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Bobby. This one's easy, Rob. Rob and Andy, can't thank you enough for what you do. Book was awesome, and these podcasts get me through my long drive home from work. For me and the rest of the listeners, can you tell the story of Evander's five fries again?
Oh, man. We could probably post a link to this one. Maybe we'll even embed the video so it doesn't disappear. But Tony Budding was interviewing Barry Sears, and, you know, Sears is in a lab coat, and they're in this kind of 1970s-style chemistry lab that looks like something from my high school, and, you know, making it look like it's all kind of scientific and stuff. But it's like this mothballed old lab, and Tony's interviewing Sears, and, you know, Sears relates the story of working with Evander Holyfield, and he asks Evander, what's your favorite meal? And, you know, it's like a hamburger and fries. And he's like, Evander, you can have that hamburger and then have five fries. And it's just hilarious. And our friends in Atlanta had great joy and mirth with this thing. So that's where the whole story came from.
The question, that story can never be told enough.
No.
I mean,
that one might be one of the t-shirts.
The inaugural t-shirts.
Yeah. Either six listeners or five fries. Yeah.
Cool. Next, we got a question from Dan. What is your perspective on club soda as a majority of water intake? I was never a soda pop drinker prior to paleo, but I kicked out much of that when I lived off for 35 years. I grabbed onto some pleasures from the Neolithic era. Club soda seems pretty innocuous, so I indulge. Can you explain to me if this is a bad thing to enjoy? What could be harmful for taking in just simple old bubbles in water?
Yeah, I think club soda is fine. Like, it might be a little bit rough on your teeth because of the acidity, but I wouldn't really. We drink a lot of bubbly water, actually. It just tastes good. So I think you're good to go. There's not really an issue with, like, long-term acid-base balance or anything like that.
Yes. Indulge.
Yes, go wild. Go wild.
Okay. Here is a lengthy one, Rob. Whew. Okay. Question from Jeremy.
You sure you want to go here?
Yeah, I think this is good. I could also tell this reminds me of the story of how I got my best 5K time. But not 5K, my best 500 meter road time. Anyway,
right.
Hello, Rob. Had something like a sugar binge last Friday. Four really good macaroons and 5 to 6 chocolate truffles, and something quite amazing happened, I thought. I had no sugar crash for about 18 hours, and in fact, elevated energy. Going to have the 2 to 3 hours of gym on Saturday made me thought I was going for it might be all right. I had so much energy that I exercised when I reached home for about 20 minutes just to burn some off, because maybe I thought I wouldn't be able to sleep with all that energy, and I thought it might not be good to let so much energy stay in my system. And then I went to sleep. It was 3 a.m., though, not common. But I woke up 5 hours later, possibly due to the biological clock, since I woke up around the time I woke up for the past days or weeks. When I woke up, I did not really feel sleepy, and in fact still had all that energy. At the gym, even though there was lack of sleep, I lifted 160 instead of the 140 I usually lift and have been lifting at for the past few weeks. It was way beyond what I've been lifting for weeks. At the almost treadmill, ski thing, not sure what it's called, I feel like I could not stop, and I just went on and on and on, double of what I usually do at 22:48 instead of the 10-minute warm-up, and I was at speed 248 pedals per minute instead of the usual 190 to 200, crazy. I kind of felt superhuman and thought that would be great for marathons. But I think I shrank after that, even though I lifted weights beyond what I've lifted for that day. I went back and looked up the effects of excess glucose energy in your book and saw how it ends up having gluconeogenesis, and thought that might be it. No crash, amazing energy levels that ended maybe 2 hours into the gym, about 18 hours after the sugar. Maybe the paleo-ish diet I've been on improved my insulin sensitivity, etc. What do you think, Rob? Wondering if carb loading before the gym has the same effect without the possible after effects of
gluconeogenesis.
Yeah, man, the discussion's so long. But instead of sugar, have sweet potatoes, yams, etc. We'll be trying that. Also wondering if my body has switched to carb mode from the more ketogenic mode from the weeks of low-carb diet. Just from one night, I would also like to hear about this aspect of the body if you have things to say about it. By paleo-ish, I mean no grains for 5 to 6 weeks since I went for 30 days and then more. Also, have you seen anyone with possibly at least some gluten tolerance and can take maybe one croissant without any effects or significant effects? I guess maybe you can tell that, can't tell that yet without having anyone on it long enough that you know of. Thanks, Rob. Wow.
Wow. Man, clear, I made a cigarette after this one. Holy cow.
I feel like reading this, he still is on a sugar high right now.
Totally. I think you have, like, English as a second language and, like, some sort of, like, a serious neurological thing going on here. You know, some ways I'm not even sure what to say other than kind of the obvious. You know, it's like you hit some points where some carb repletion is smart. One carb meal is not going to completely bounce you out of the metabolic pathway of preferential using fat as a fuel source. Gluten is bad news for everybody. Like Matt Lalonde and I will talk more about that when he comes on the show. I've got a, you know, I detail a lot of this stuff in the book too. Some people are more asymptomatic than not. Some people kind of tolerate it better than not. But we have some issues with zonulin and with gut permeability that affects everybody. Like it's just not really a question with that. In toxicology, there's this concept called LD50, lethal dose 50, where like if we took a known dose of say radiation and we exposed 100 mice to this known radiation, there's a lethal dose 50 in which 50% of those mice would die from that radiation. So 50% die, 50% don't. So is radiation bad? Yes. Do 50% of them die? Yes. Why don't the other ones die? We're not super sure. But it's still bad, you know, and then you can have an LD100 where we know, okay, this is the guaranteed level at which all of them die. And usually you start getting many standard deviations outside what the LD50 is because you have some genetic variations and some different stuff like that that usually inoculate some individuals. So you always have some variability in this stuff, but this is one of those like just kind of take it to the bank deals, which is gluten is a problem. If you want to play around with a croissant a week or whatever, knock yourself out. My main deal is trying to get people who are sick and inflamed to give this a shot. And then from there, I don't really care what you do. Play around with it, see what you can get away with. But for me, it's kind of a deal of like, do I have a croissant or do I have some dark chocolate covered almonds? Because I know the dark chocolate covered almonds are you know, barely negative to me, possibly beneficial in some ways. Whereas like I know for a fact that the croissant is kind of death for me. Maybe other people will tolerate it better, but it's just some really simple trade-offs that I try to encourage people to tinker with. So. Anything else, Andy, on that train wreck of a question?
No, but my best 500K rowing time was after I had 14 chocolate chip cookies on Christmas Eve.
Mm, there you go. Carb repletion, man.
And then I almost vomited.
Then Andy died, and we brought him back.
But I went fast.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Eric D. Great podcast. I have two items I'd like to hear your opinion on. The first one is Martin Berkham's lean gains, not really his training protocol, but more so his nutrition aspect, also assuming his program has followed the paleo standards with higher carbs coming from yams, squashes, etc. Is this something that is really healthy in the long term? I know you're crazy busy, so a yes-no would be great.
I like it. I like Martin's stuff. He's had, I think, in a lot of ways, some really good success because the group of people he has historically worked with have been more like bodybuilder oriented, and so the volumes and the intensities of the training they're doing are a little more sane. I think I had mixed results with the people that we were working with because, you know, and I wrote about this back in 2005, I think was the first time that I had an intermittent fasting article published, and I had been thinking about it and working with people for years before that. But coming out of the CrossFit scene and the glycogen depletion elements, the potential for overtraining and stuff like that, I didn't really see as good a result, or it was more mixed, particularly when you had people who were like police, military, fire, who had dodgy sleep schedules and stuff like that. The intermittent fasting ended up being problematic. But other than that, I think Martin's approach is really smart. His use of branched-chain amino acids at fasting hours beyond like 14 or 16 hours or whatever, I think is really smart too. Totally legit stuff.
And they're not beating themselves into a pulp.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think helps.
Yeah.
Second question also, and this may hit closer to home for you. My Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu strength and conditioning is based around Wendler's amazing 531. Wow, now it's amazing. Next month, my deadlift is going to go up to over 400 pounds, back squat over 370, press 185, and weighted pull-up at 125. I weigh 180 to 185. I like lifting a lot, but when is it enough? I am one of the, if not the strongest guys on the mats, and BJJ is not really a strength sport. I'm into mat performance, longevity of training, and staying lean. I believe it was Rip who said something along the lines that strength training beyond intermediate levels is pointless if you're not in a strength sport because of programming and recovery involved in more advanced strength levels. So, in your opinion, when is enough strength, and when does it begin to not be worth the effort to progress and just maintain? Also, I don't have the time or recoverability to roll every single day. 4 times a week rolling and 2 day strength training is a great balance for me and keeps me from overtraining. So more mat time instead of lifting would shoot cortisol out of my ears, funk my sleep because class goes till 8 and throw me close to overtraining. Thanks for the input. Hope your jits is going well and keep rolling.
Yeah, it's probably at strength levels that you need for jits. After having Ido come and hang out, like, I've really shifted. I'm doing a ton more gymnastics again and some capoeira derivative stuff, a bunch of ring routine work, and I have what's called like a straight arm day, a bent arm day, and then a lower body day. The lower body day is activation work, some power cleans, power snatches, and then usually a back squat, front squat, Zercher lift or something like that. But I really like, I dig the mobility plus strength element of the gymnastics movements, front levers, back levers, skin the cats, planches, press to handstands, and all that sort of jive. They're very, very difficult to gauge progression. Like, the nice thing about Wendler is just that it's a very easy progression that you can track with weighted pull-ups, dips, bench, press, you know, like the whole gig. The gymnastics derivatives are more challenging, but I will guarantee you that the mobility that you get out of that, plus the strength and mobility, is so much more appropriate for jits. Like, it's more appropriate for just about everything. Like, I think a heavily gymnastics-oriented upper body training deal and then some lower body training with a back squat, deadlift, power clean, power snatch, glute ham raises, you know, sprints and all that, you could build a really cool 2-day-a-week template and tinker with that. But I think your numbers are as good as they need to be, you know, particularly if you just want to be good at jits. What I would start really looking at is mobility and power development.
Yep, yep. The only thing I'm just talking about, I totally agree about it's tough to visualize progress, but some people actually have done videos of them and coming back, and shooting is not easily measured. I think some people that spin them out.
Right.
You know, but could not agree more anymore. And pre-CrossFit, I didn't count everything. I had cooler stuff, and I did a lot more gymnastics.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to skip the next one, Rob, because that's a beast, and come back to it next week. And we're going to drop down to number 10. Question from Ben. Rob, 3 questions without an S. 1, what supplements are you currently taking? Go.
Supplements, I'm taking Tribulus, Chinese medicine formula, Wutan, I believe is what it is. And then some, what else am I taking? Some digestive enzymes and Natural Calm.
2. What supplements would you add to your diet if all your meat was grain-fed?
CLA, alpha-lipoic acid, and I would try to get some palm oil, red palm oil, in some meals.
Cool. 3, are Twinkies paleo?
Twinkies are definitely paleo if they are zone ratioed with a little bit of chicken breast. Or actually with some seitan, which is concentrated wheat gluten, because food quality really doesn't matter on
that. Seitan. I'm still waiting for the classic joke of someone to have the paleoish.diet.com rolled out, Rob.
Paleoish?
I think that could be worldwide. P.S., the new website is pretty rad, but going to be honest and say I'm a little bummed with no forum.
Dude, just wait. We're working on a forum. Can't do it all in one day.
Yes. All right, number 12, question from Tane. Gents, I only listened to the podcast now as I've been away. I did hear about the Twinkie debate during my travels, however. Reference Professor Twinkie. Is it fair to boil his hypocaloric Twinkie diet down to consuming less poison is better for you than consuming more poison? While I'm on a roll, the unknown and unknowable Untreak Paratus issue. If no summation of leg extensions, leg press, hamstring curls, and calf raises will equal a squat, can we posit that 60 kipping pull-ups doesn't equal being able to climb a cliff? Comment from Rob. Yeah, this is what Irwan has seen in some elite CrossFit folks, great capacity and a complete inability to climb real-world objects. At some point, you have to work technique and expand skill set, not just sweat.
Yeah. Tane's genius wins through again.
I actually want to make a t-shirt, Rob, that just says, not just sweat. I give it to all my freaking clients. Do you have anything else you want to say about that genius question from Tane?
Is that a question or is this Cliff deal?
Well, this is Tane, so it's a question, comment. It's all rolled into one, really. It's just... we should have tweeted this, I think.
I don't know. I almost feel like saying anything would sully the whole thing. You know, it's there's no doubt, like, that place you want to start looking, and this is it's hard to get people fired up about it because it's that like the monkey with its hand in a jar. You got to put one thing down to pick something else up. But if you want to chase capacity, the place to chase it is in technique and skills. And to do that, you need to be mindful, you need to be rested, you need to not be neurologically cooked. And now, are there places where it's appropriate to burn the candles hard and do all that? You know, like if you're a CrossFit gamer or something, yeah, absolutely. But the thing is that... working different legitimate gymnastics progressions, getting real technical in the lifts, getting real technical in your sprinting, swimming for God's sake, you know, all that stuff, that's where the greatest development is happening, not simply having an epileptic seizure to burn a lot of calories. Like, that's the most caloric output you can have, is to induce a seizure in somebody. You can break bones at the same time, so not only are you... expending calories hand over fist, you know, you're snapping bones and stuff, but there's nothing particularly productive about that. So, you know, chasing some capacity, getting some skill set, knowing how to macro climb. There were some great CrossFit journals, you know, backer ladders, cargo nets, and all that sort of stuff. But it's difficult to quantify, similar to getting people excited about being upside down and running around on their hands. And it doesn't leave you gasping for breath. And you know, we encounter some of this kick pushback from our own clients who want to work out really hard. But the funny thing is, it's all of the people who are the most orthopedically fudged up are the ones who do not care much about building skill set and whatnot. Like, they just want kind of a boot camp kind of gig and just work out hard and that's it. Which you need to supply people to some degree what they want, but in some ways you need to try to wrap enough chocolate around the medicine to to get them also in addition to what they want, what they need. So,
and I'm also going to say that some of that, the fact that they want to work hard, I actually think they actually just want to sweat and feel like they work hard. Because for several of the people we've done some programming for, something like 500-meter repeats with lengthy rest in between was their least favorite workouts. Why? Because it was actually really freaking hard, and they couldn't, like, hide from some of the pain like they could with a barbell clean lunge push-up situation.
Right.
Because, you know, actual sprint repeats and things is actually really hard work, and you can't convince yourself that it's quasi-hard work.
Yeah, and that was one of these things that... watching the Jay Schrader Freak of Training video, and then I was actually at CrossFit Santa Cruz way back in the day, and it was myself and Dave Camarillo, Greg Almondson, a bunch of really good, like a bunch of legit dude athletes, and this was when I wasn't, you know, fat and old and beat up and everything, and actually had some pretty good capacity. But we did a relay Helen, and I think I related this thing in that Power Bias article that I wrote, where, you know, normally Helen is a 400-meter run, 21 kettlebell swings, 12 pull-ups, you know, repeat three times. But what this thing was sprint for, you know, one guy on each team sprinted the 400 meters, tags a partner on his team, then that person kettlebell swings 21 reps, and then they tag somebody on the team, and then they the next person does the pull-ups. Or basically it was you could slice and dice the workload any way you wanted, but it was in a conga line or like a tag team kind of format. And it was the worst workout I ever did. And there have been a lot of them, but it was like a bunch of very fit people. But then in between each element, you typically had about a minute of recovery, depending on how it all went, sometimes close to 2 minutes of recovery. But that 400-meter run was a dead sprint because I wanted to get back and then tag my partner so that they could get going. I didn't want to let them down. So you had the team competition element, which was really, really, you know, like demanding, but then also the fact that you were sprinting each element, like on the kettlebell swings, you were exploding them up as hard as you could, but then snapping them back down, like decelerating them at the top of the arc and then snapping them back down to try to speed up the cycle time. And then kind of the same deal on the pull-ups. You weren't kind of languidly going up and then collecting your kinetic energy on the way back down. You'd snap yourself over, drive yourself back under, and turn these things over really quickly, and it was horrible. So I'm not super sure what my point is on that, but you know what...
Hiding from hard work. I don't know if that's what it started.
Yeah, it's interesting that the interval type stuff is just terrible. It can be more terrible than stringing it all together. And you know, interestingly, this was a lot of the recommendation that I made for programming for people to slice up blocks of their year doing workouts like this, intervals within intervals, and then you cruise over to OPT's WODs, and they do a ton of stuff like this. Just a ton of it. Do they do all their work like this? No, absolutely not. And I think he's really focusing the bulk of his efforts on this whole kind of sport of fitness thing. That's where his kind of wheelhouse really is. But he ends up breaking all these elements apart and then reintegrating them back together and trying to, in the process,